We've got three distinguished guests this evening, all from UVA, and we're going to give three different perspectives on the healthcare reform that just got passed, starting with a nice overview from Carolyn Engelhardt on what exactly is in the new bill and maybe a couple of things that aren't in the new bill that should have been, according to Carolyn. So this is Carolyn Engelhardt, and she also wrote a book, Healthcare Half-Truths, and she is a professor of public health sciences at UVA.
Thanks, Bevy. So hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out. So to paraphrase our vice president without the expletive adjective, this really is a big deal. And a long time coming. You know, it's been over a century since we've attempted some kind of national health care reform in this country. It started back with Teddy Roosevelt, went through FDR, Truman.
Can everybody hear?
No.
No, he's been on
the floor. I've never been accused of being soft-spoken.
Is that mic on?
Yeah, but
it is,
it's just recording.
It's
so, anyway... during the Q&A, if you want, we can get into as much of the details as you want, but I'll just summarize a little bit. When Senator Obama campaigned to be president, he ran on a platform of health care reform, and he said what was important to him was to expand coverage, to control health care costs, and to improve quality in our health care system. And in saying that, we look at the bill that was passed, and we say, did it expand coverage? Yes, by 2019, 95% of all legal Americans will have health insurance coverage. There will be subsidies to help people afford it. There will also be an individual mandate for people to purchase health insurance. That was a bit controversial, a part of it, but... you really can't have one without the other. You can't have universal coverage unless you make people have insurance. Cost control, did we control costs? I would give that in the bill a B-. There's not a lot of cost control in the bill. They are hoping that through some of the prevention and wellness and people having insurance won't put off getting care till they're really sick. There are some demonstration projects through Medicare that will change the way we pay physicians, that'll move more towards paying them through bundled payments or episodes of care, and will move away from what we know of as the fee-for-service system, which incentivizes volume care for people who do procedures particularly. And as far as changes in quality of care, again, there are these demonstrations that like the patient-centered medical home, that will enable primary care physicians to manage chronic illness better. But it's not, there's not a whole lot of it in the bill explicitly. So yes, expanded coverage, not very good cost control. And we'll have to see if we have better quality care. There are two new institutes through Medicare, one called an innovation center that will experiment with some of the ways healthcare is delivered in order to improve quality. The other is to look at the way physicians and hospitals are paid to try to control costs. President Obama and his people are not stupid, as you know, and so they knew that if these things didn't roll out until 2014, as the major aspects are, the subsidies, the mandates to buy health insurance, that we'd be through the midterm elections by then, and people would probably be just as disgruntled as they are beforehand. So there are some things that are going to roll out immediately. Within the next 90 days, Secretary Sebelius has already contacted the states about setting up or enlarging their high-risk pools. There's going to be an infusion of national money, federal funds, to help people who are currently uninsured because of pre-existing conditions to be able to purchase health insurance in a high-risk pool. There are also some other things that will happen pretty immediately. insurance companies within the next 6 months, depending on when insurance plans are renewed, will no longer be able to have annual limits on what they can spend. They can't drop people when they get sick. So there'll be some insurance regulations that'll protect consumers. The Medicare donut hole, if any of you are over 65 and have Medicare, the Medicare donut hole this year will have a rebate of $250 if you enter the donut hole. In 2011, there'll actually be a 50% discount on brand name drugs in the donut hole. And so those are the things that are sort of coming through immediately. But the take home message is that eventually, by 2014 and beyond, we should have a system where insurance company, unless it's repealed, which I really don't think it will be, but we should have a system where insurance companies are more like regulated utilities. Most Americans will be able to have access to affordable health insurance, and hopefully we'll be able to deliver care that's more efficient and more effective. So I think I'll stop there. Fortunately, no one in the back has given me that sign yet that I've gone over my time. So I think I'll stop there, and we can have Q&A later.
All right. Thank you, Carolyn. Up next, we've got Robert Powers, a professor of emergency medicine and an emergency room physician, and he taught a course just this January on the American healthcare system, and he's going to give another take on things.
Thank you, and again, thank you for coming. Once this passed, a number of people contacted me and said, well, what does this mean for physicians? And my answer to them was the answer that I give now to most questions, which is it depends. And it depends on who you are and who you take care of. If you are a physician now who's been taking care of lots of poor people and lots of sick people, this is probably great news, because it's possible that you would be able to do the same amount of work and be compensated better for it. Just to give you an example of what kind of economics we're talking about, on average, a patient that we see at the university who is uninsured, we will be lucky if we get 6 cents on the dollar out of them relative to our charges. How many of you would work for 6% of your billings? Anybody out there in retail or any lawyer out there that would work for 6% return on their billings? So it's been a tough market, and I think if you are in the business of caring for the poor and the uninsured as an institution or a physician, this is great news. It's great news if you are one of those people who is poor or uninsured or sick, because it now means that you have a better chance of accessing health care services. Being uninsured and being poor is not just inconvenient, it's quite dangerous. The health of that group of the population suffers greatly from their lack of access. So this bill does good things for that group of people. It is very unsettling to those of us who are already doing okay in terms of our health insurance and our health, because it seems impossible that it won't rock the boat somewhere in terms of somehow shifting either resources or comfort out of the comfortable into the uncomfortable realm. That remains to be seen. But there's a lot of concern among physicians and among insured patients that this is bad news. So it depends on your perspective. It depends on what you were looking for. If you felt badly that we were doing not enough for too many and too much for some, then this is great news. If you felt like you were getting great care and it was terrific because you didn't have to pay for it because your insurance covered it all and you could get whatever you want whenever you wanted it, this may not be such good news. It takes a nice stab at the three problems we had, which were excessive cost, limited access, and variable quality. It doesn't fix any of them. The major concern is that it is not going to get close to attacking the cost. If you think about medicine as a house where you get in and get stuff done to you, we've had two problems. The stuff being done is expensive and in many cases inappropriate and not even effective. But some people couldn't even get it. this allows people in the house. The house is now full of 35 or so million more people who have a ticket in their hand. If we just do the same thing to them that we've been doing to everybody else all these years, which is high technology, low efficacy care, we're going to go bankrupt. So now that everybody's inside, we're going to have to change what we do inside, or it's just going to run the costs up beyond the point. Some of you must be NPR listeners. On the way over here tonight, there was a story that was just speaks beautifully about the problem. Between 2002 and 2007, the incidence of complex back surgery in this country has gone up 15-fold for Medicare patients. This is a procedure which takes about 6 hours and compensates about $6,000 to the physician. It works no better than a procedure which takes a little less than an hour and compensates the physician $600. And yet we do it 15 times more than we did in 2002. This is something we all agree scientifically doesn't work. But we're doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. People, you go to Midas, you get a muffler. You show up in a physician's office with the ability to pay for something, you're going to get stuff done. And the current system favors that. We all know that. We all have a hard time resisting it. This bill doesn't really change that much. It may limit the total pie of money, in which case eventually we won't be able to do everything that we'd like to do, but it doesn't really get at that too well. The last thing I'll say is the access piece. Good news for the 35 million who were shut out completely or partially before, although there's heavy reliance in this bill on Medicaid to cover uninsured people. I got news for you. Medicaid doesn't function terribly well as health insurance. If you want to have some fun sometime, pick up the phone book in Charlottesville or any other city or town and start going through the phone book among private physicians and try to make an appointment and tell them you have Medicaid. Economists call it health insurance, and they're right. But if health insurance is a proxy for access to private medicine, Medicaid isn't health insurance. Very few private physicians, very few private hospitals will encourage or even take Medicaid patients. So expecting this flood of newly medicated patients to all of a sudden have doctors to care for them is a pipe dream. And that's going to be an interesting thing to shake out. The last thing is, what about the 15 million illegal aliens who aren't covered in this? Who's going to take care of them? Are they going to stop getting sick because they don't have health insurance? There's no provision at all to provide any care for these patients. I don't know where they're going to... Actually, I do know where they're going to go. They're going to go right where they're going right now, which is public hospital emergency rooms. So this is not a solution. Ignoring them and pretending they don't exist and pretending they aren't sick is not only unethical and cruel, but it's a public health problem. Because they're the ones that are coughing tuberculosis all over your children. And if nobody's around to take care of them, they're going to get sicker, and we're going to suffer collectively, not only in our health, but in the fabric of the society. So leaving them out, I think, was politically necessary, but it begs the question of who's supposed to take care of them and who's going to pay for that care. They're not going away. They're going to need care. They're sick. Someone's got to do it. There's no means for funding it in this bill. And I'll leave that to the ethicist.
That's a wrong choice.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks,
it is an ethical question, for sure.
So finishing up the roundup is John Aris, a professor of biomedical ethics and philosophy, and he's going to talk about the ethical side of things.
Okay, so I've got about 5 or 10 minutes to speak. Funny story there. I attended the second International AIDS Conference, which was held in Montreal back in the 80s. And there were, you know, all these AIDS activist signs up, you know, from ACT UP, silence equals death, okay? And there, too, we were told that we had 10 minutes to speak. So a friend of mine got up and said, if silence equals death, having 10 minutes to speak means I've already got 1 foot in the grave, okay? Tom just mentioned the political unfeasibility of confronting the immigration issue head on. I want to confront the other big issue, which is also political and also unspeakable in this country, and therefore an unsolved problem. And that's the problem of cost containment and rationing. Okay, so clearly, more universal, you know, extended coverage and cost containment go together. You can't have universal coverage unless you limit the costs of the system. Otherwise, we'll just simply go broke. But if you set out in a serious way to control costs, then you get accused of killing people, okay? Then you get accused of rationing health care, which is the work of Satan, all right? These are the death panels that we're all so much afraid of in this country, okay? So for my taste, there's not enough rationing in this bill. I just want to sort of focus. So my role here, if you want to know what's in this bill, you know, and what's going to actually happen, talk to Carolyn and Tom, okay? Because they know this stuff. Tom also. Is there a Tom here that could be accessed? the stuff that I do in my scholarship and teaching is applying theories of justice to the area of healthcare. Okay, so I'm sort of at a remove from the nuts and bolts of the healthcare debate in a way. But on the question of rationing, I want to just directly confront it, okay, and talk about it as an ethical question. Rationing in this country is an unspeakable issue. When the Clintons were in office, my boss, I was teaching then at Einstein Medical School in New York City. My boss was a member of Hillary Clinton's task force. They were told under, you know, Ira Magaziner, remember? They were told that they should never, ever use the word rationing in any document that escaped that committee, okay? And that sort of prohibition of talk about rationing continues through this interminable healthcare debate that we've just had. And to me, what this represents is that we are not grown-ups with regard to issues of cost containment. We can't have an adult conversation in this country. Okay, so I want to just take you through this very quickly. How do we define rationing? Well, rationing is not the denial of completely, utterly useless care. I mean, nobody would have an objection to getting rid of something that was totally useless. But all of this stuff is potentially useful. Oh, okay. All of this, yeah, I'm with you, actually. All of this stuff is potentially useful to some people, okay? And so I define rationing as the denial of access to a treatment that could be possibly beneficial to people on grounds of cost, okay, or lack of cost effectiveness. And it seems to me that given the fact that in the United States here and around the world, the medical technology is exploding, we're getting new cures, new techniques, new vaccines, new everything all the time. And this is what's driving the cost up, okay? But often, we're not getting a hell of a lot for the bucks, all right? I mean, my favorite example lately that guys my age might appreciate is prostate screening, all right? The guy who discovered the PSA antigen recently ran an op-ed in the New York Times with the headline, you know, public health disaster, okay? In other words, the PSA test and the prostate surgery that follows it, he regards as a complete public health disaster. There was a European study done that showed that something like 48 people have to be operated on at the risk of impotence and incontinence in order to save one life over a certain period of time. And I could go on and on and on, right? Avastin, cancer drug. Bob, what's the effectiveness of a drug like that? What's the cost of a drug like that? Okay, so we're talking about
tens of thousands of dollars for a few months.
Tens of thousands. You know, because what? As a philosopher, I'll just use quantitative figures, like a lot. Okay. Carolyn is my source here. Okay, so tens of thousands of dollars for a couple of weeks or maybe months. And this is just a microcosm. We just do this across the board, which is probably why Bob was gasping when I said that, you know, that this stuff does tend to benefit some people. Well, actually, that prostate screening maybe does benefit some people, you know, who had wildly out of control prostate cancer, and it might have been screened and fixed. But for every one of those, every life you save, you got to operate on 48 more, okay, who just get tons of grief from that surgery. So it's a very simple point. We're cranking out huge amounts of medical care that is marginally effective and extremely expensive. Okay, and if anybody believes that we can just give universal access to that and expand it exponentially the way we're envisioning, they're just crazy. Okay, this is simply not going to happen. And we know that places that do deliver excellent care, that know how to do it, places like Kaiser in California, where my brother works in Napa, you know, some people have all the luck, or Mayo Clinic, they take this kind of issue very seriously, right? I mean, and they have limits on what they will do, and the doctors aren't paid on a fee-for-service basis. That is a kind of rationing, okay? They won't make certain kinds of drugs available if they don't prove themselves. That's a kind of rationing. So it's just a fallacy to think that the government is the only entity that rations health care and that that's somehow despicable. Private insurance companies ration health care every day. They will say what they will pay for and what they won't. And of course, our country as a whole rations health care currently, or, you know, until very recently, to 48 million people on the basis of their inability to pay. That's rationing, and that's rationing in the most unconscionable way imaginable. Okay? So for me, the question isn't whether we will ration health care. The question is how we're going to ration health care and what will be rationed, right? So what sort of substantive principles will we use? Cost-effectiveness analysis might be a decent start. And what sort of process? Are we going to have people in smoke-filled rooms, you know, with green eye shades making these decisions? Or are these going to be, in some sense, accountable decisions that citizens can contest and get a conversation going about, like they have in the state of Oregon, okay? So that's where we've got to move to, I think. And I don't see this bill coming close to that. I mean, a great example of this is I've got a friend, Zeke Emanuel, whose brother is Rahm Emanuel, you know, the chief of staff in the White House. Zeke is a good friend and colleague of mine. He does bioethics up at the NIH, okay? Zeke has been writing very intelligent articles on rationing healthcare all of his adult life. When he gets on the Obama team, he stops talking this way. He says, we really won't need to ration care if we just deliver care in a sensible way. I think this is just completely delusional, you know, or Machiavellian, or, you know, one or the other, but it's not the truth, okay? So for me, rationing is absolute. I mean, not to ration health care is unethical, I would argue, because then people are getting more health care than they would be willing to pay for themselves if they had the money, right? So, rationing, good. That's my final. Okay? If you want a really sophisticated philosophical account of this, there it is. Rationing, good. Okay?
Necessary.
Good.
Yeah, necessary.
Necessary, good for tribe, good for nation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's open it up for questions. Brian?
Yes. Well, I may have some misconceptions about the new configuration of the how the healthcare is going to work. But my understanding was that people will have to be mandated to buy health insurance under this bill. And what is going to prevent the insurance industry from raising premiums as a result of that? Now, I know that we're supposed to have an exchange whereby the more people who come into the system, the more equitable the costs for everyone, if I've characterized that correctly. But this is all theoretical. So what are the worst things that could happen? What's the worst case scenario? And what are these theories about the health the exchange is based upon?
Okay, I'll start. The worst case scenario is that when people are required to buy health insurance, the healthy won't, and they'll pay the penalty instead, and the only people who will go into the insurance pool are sick people who need insurance, and that will definitely drive premiums up. But remember, the exchanges will only service about 23 million people. This is not the 160 million people who already get their health insurance from their jobs. Those people probably won't see very much difference at all. The Congressional Budget Office did a review of that last fall, and they came out and said that by 2019, people in employer-based health insurance will see a very small decrease in their premium. And that people who are going to the exchanges, who are the people now who either have individual health insurance and are paying, if they can get it at all, and are paying huge amounts, and the previously uninsured who have vouchers or subsidies to go to the exchange to purchase health insurance, that their health insurance may actually cost a little bit more than they're currently paying if they're paying out of pocket, but it will be more comprehensive. So, I mean, that's kind of the bad news and the good news. Now, there is a federal oversight. Secretary Sebelius under HHS will be reviewing rates that insurance companies roll out. So little did the head of WellPoint in California realize it, but I mean, the health care reform bill had died. When Scott Brown was elected in Massachusetts and they no longer had 60 votes in the Senate, overnight the language out of the White House went from, we have to have health care no matter what, to, what health care? Let's have jobs. Let's try to make jobs.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the individual health insurance market in California, WellPoint, the insurer, raised their rates by 39%, and that got so much play in the media that it got legs again. And that's when the president said, okay, we're going to go for broke. So,
by the way, I think we should all send WellPoint like a fruit basket or something.
Yeah. So the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, will be reviewing rate changes. And if they are too high, I'm assuming there will be some countervailing pressure. But one of the things you have to remember is we all want to change the insurance industry. We don't want people with pre-existing conditions to be closed out of the insurance system. In order to make that happen, you have to get everybody into the pool. Because if you don't, the people who aren't going to buy health insurance are going to be the people who don't need it, by and large, or can't afford it. And those are the healthy people we need in the pool to keep the premium stable. That's why 30% of 19 to 29-year-olds do not have health insurance. We need to get them in the pool so that we can amortize that risk. It works the same for your homeowner's insurance or your car insurance or any other insurance product. And the third thing we have to do is provide subsidies so that people can afford health insurance. And that's why we had to have the insurance mandate. There had to be subsidies in order to regulate insurance companies so that they couldn't drop people and they had to take people who had pre-existing conditions. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen. But all I can tell you is when Social Security was passed and when Medicare was passed, they both, the, the Republicans said they would repeal the laws within the next year, and they all claimed doomsday. And now you ask anybody, would they give back their Social Security or their Medicare program? And I will tell you, everybody will say no. In fact,
keep your government hands off my
exactly.
Medicare.
Yeah. So I hope that was an answer.
I would just follow up on that. Once you abandon the idea of a single payer, and you leave the funding of healthcare in the private sector, which is what we've decided to do here, you have to use insurance. Insurance is not inherently evil. As long as you regulate it, it makes perfect sense. And if you go, because you need a bunch of healthy people who don't use, whose money isn't used, to go to pay for the people whose money is used. Insurance is a bet. You're betting the company you're going to get sick. They're betting you that you're not. And they're going to use your money. They're going to have to use your money to somebody who does get sick. But if they do this actuarially correctly, they're going to end up ahead. The difference is what defines ahead. If you look at the Western European countries outside of Britain and places like France that pay directly for healthcare from the government, most of them use insurance models. Switzerland, Germany, places like that use insurance, but they use regulated insurance. I'd go back to Carolyn's model of the public utilities. They limit their profits, they fix their rates, they tell them what they have to offer, they tell them what they can't do, they allow them to make a profit and run a decent business, they just don't allow them to do it excessively. So it isn't a bad thing that insurance is in this. It's going to need to be tinkered with some before we go. And we'll see. I would like to, while I've got the floor here, mention something early on. I think in John's address, he said no one would object to us not doing something that was unnecessary or foolish. The most
overstatement.
All right. The most discouraging thing that's come out, I think, lately, and was actually before the healthcare bill passed, was coincident with the announcement that prostate screening did no good, was some great news about mammography. Okay? We did some science. We recommend this is how science is supposed to work. We thought something would be good, and so we did it to a whole bunch of people. Millions. In fact, millions and millions and millions of women got these mammograms. And then we stopped and said, boy, we got a lot of data here. Let's go back and see if we were right. And it turned out we were wrong. So I heard this report and I thought, this is fantastic news. Here's an announcement. Women between 40 and 50, great news for you. This expensive, worrisome, painful, invasive, awful thing that you have to go through every year, you don't have to do it anymore. Did the women of the United States stand up and say, fantastic? No. What did they say? Don't confuse me with the facts. I want this. I demand it. And I'm not paying for it.
And don't ration.
And I'm not paying for it. Don't you dare ration. I have a right to have somebody do something to me which is of no value. And I'm going to insist that it be done. Yes, ma'am.
I just...
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, earlier, the point about prostate screening, it isn't just the occasional patient that benefits, it's the physician that benefits.
Oh.
If I see you in my office and I don't order any tests, there's only a certain amount of money I can get out of you or your insurance company. But if I order tests, I get more money. The more tests I order, the more money I get, even if they're not my tests. And the reimbursement system is so skewed toward doing things to people, regardless of their value, that we're spinning out of control in terms of cost containment.
Right.
I've been in practice long enough to remember when there were no CAT scans. And you know what? Everybody didn't die. And then along came MRI scans. I see people now that have had 12 of them in a year. They're no healthier than they were 5 years ago when they had no MRI scans. But we just love these things. And the system is perverse. It encourages me to order them. It encourages you to ask for them. And it irregardless, actually, of whether they're of any value at all. So the heart of this problem in terms of cost inflation is the piecework system that we currently have.
Yeah. Could I just take a swing at the bat on the same? I agree with everything you just said, Bob, except for your swipe at my generalization, okay? I agree with absolutely everything you said. We didn't see the American Academy of Urology coming out against prostate screening, right? Because their bread is being buttered on that side, okay? But What I meant was that on average or on the whole or by and large, patients don't benefit from a lot of this high-tech, high-cost, marginal benefit. But they're marginally beneficial in the sense that some people are benefited, okay? Not nearly enough to justify the effort and the cost and the pain and suffering, but, you know, you can't say that zero people have been benefited. That's the only point
You're never down there at benefiting nobody.
Exactly. That's the only point that I wanted to make. Yeah.
The rationing argument is very clear and needs to be done. One of the areas that actually has to be looked at is Medicare.
Yeah.
For that demographic, our current medical spending per Medicare beneficiary is about $12,000 per year in account cost, which is enormous.
Per person.
Per person. This per beneficiary per year is on Medicare. We cannot afford that going into the future. It's going to continue to rise the way it's going.
Yeah.
What would you suggest for? That's the place to really start. How do you do
yeah.
That?
Well, okay. So we're venturing into the world of factual. So I'm in way over my pay grade here. Okay. But one thing that does really stand out for me is that in order for a procedure or drug to get approved in this country, you go to the FDA, and you don't have to show anything other than that it's more effective than a placebo. Okay. That's basically so it has to be more effective than a placebo and adequately safe, okay, whatever that means. But there's absolutely no demand that a new drug be deemed, you know, as good as or better than what is out there already, or that it justify itself in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. I mentioned this cancer drug Avastin a while back. This is a classic example of a drug that is being used for everything now, you know, not just what it's, you know, approved for, but it's being used everywhere, and there's hardly any data to show that it's really effective, okay? So you can call it a death panel if you want, but we've got to have some kind of mechanism to get a hold of just that kind of explosive growth in the medical sector.
There is a mechanism already. There is a committee on Medicare that says these are the things that we can do, and they're effective. What happens is yep. It becomes very politicized. For example, they had said that a particular MRI, the cardiac MRI, was not effective for this particular demographic. It was way too expensive for its outcome. What happened was the manufacturer went to their congressman, and the congressman got together and they passed a rule saying no, the committee can't do that for this, and thus it was allowed. I mean, so politics comes into this really fast.
Yeah.
There are pieces of the bill that try to put more checks and balances into place. Whether they'll be politicized to the point, to the extent that they are now, I can't say. I do know that. Remember when Obama rolled this out initially, and part of the criticism about it was that he seemed to change his tune so many times about what we were doing. Is this a moral issue? Is it an economic issue? But originally, he basically said, you know, healthcare spending is the economy. You know, the economy can't absorb the trajectory of growth of healthcare spending. I can only tell you, in the bill, the MedPAC, the group you're talking about, will get more legislative authority. There will be more. There are more pieces that look at if Medicare spending increases faster than the economy grows, than GDP, then there's some group that's bound to come in, legislatively required to come in and look at it and make recommendations. Will it work? I don't know. We have to crawl before we walk. I think that was the best they could do, given those constraints. And some of the Medicare demonstration projects really move away from the fee-for-service, let's do it again and again and again because we get paid more, our patients want it, and all of that, more towards we're going to give you a bundled payment. It's going to be like a one sum of money. Here, take it. You manage your patients. That'll take away some of the incentive to do. check back in 5 years and let's ask this question again.
Well, the mechanism for this, if we would be grown-ups, is already in place. It's like the base closing commissions that they have for the military. They put these people in a room and they agree beforehand, we're going to do what you say we're supposed to do and we're not allowed to get at it. The frustrating thing for me is we don't even have to do the research. We already know this stuff doesn't work. We already know it doesn't work. Our problem is stopping people from doing it anyway. The solution, unfortunately, is in the money. Physicians are very adept at doing what they're paid for and very adept at not doing what they're not paid for. Unfortunately, those two are uncoupled to the value, to the patient. So we do a lot of stuff that we get money for that's useless, and we ignore simple things like immunization or blood pressure control, which is enormously helpful. So the money's the problem and the solution. If you align the money in the right place, we'll find it. You all have put the money under the wrong rocks. If you put the money under the right rocks, you'll be healthy. You stuck it under the MRI rock and the back surgery rock. And we found you need to stick it under the control your blood pressure and give you a flu shot rock. And we'll find it there too. We'll find the money. We'll also turn away from stuff that works if we're not paid for it. That this is a harsh indictment of my own profession, but I believe it strongly, having done this now. Sir?
What about the actual valid criticism that once we purchase insurance, we view every single treatment that we get as free? You know, I realize that the excise tax is supposed to deal with some of that, so you are more aware of what insurance actually costs you if you're getting it from an employer. But how do you deal with the fact that people still see it as free? See treatment as free?
Well, yeah, it's exactly what Bob says. You hit them in the wallet. So, and what you're talking about, the term you're talking about is called moral hazard. And that basically means that because the price of the medical service and the third-party payer pays it, people say, well, why not have that MRI? It's only a $30 copay. You know, I'm worried that my headache is a brain tumor. Whereas if you said, well, it's actually going to cost you $500, then people might say, well, I might think differently about
that.
But so what will happen is, as the insurance companies want to raise it, I mean, the insurance companies are, I'm not a big fan of them, but they have a very good point to make. In some ways, all they do is pass the cost along. The costs are done out there by physicians and hospitals and patients demanding. The insurers say, okay, then if you want to eat so well, you're going to have to pay more. And so employers pay more, employees pay more. Employees don't realize it, but it means what happens for them is their wages just stagnate. Because as the health insurance increases, the employers have to take it out of something, and they usually take it out of their wages. So you'll see that health insurance has grown 130% over the last 10 years, and wages have grown 24%. That's because all those wages you were going to get have gone to pay for health insurance. So what will happen is, as the health insurers are regulated and kept from raising their rates so much, they're going to turn around and they're going to make plans that aren't so generous, and they're going to make people pay more copays, hopefully based on evidence, so that if you really want that MRI without going through X, Y, and Z first, you're going to have to buy it a la carte. It may take a while, but that's the way that will be addressed.
But are there any regulations to make sure that they base those copays or those denials on evidence?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. There in the stimulus bill that was passed a year ago, there was $1 billion for a comparative effectiveness institute, and in the healthcare reform bill, there's more money to conduct studies comparing medical management for lower back pain versus surgery, comparing, well, they've done so much with PSAs. I mean, they know that. But comparing, there are lots of things like that. Yes, so there will be more studies like that commissioned. There will be more information. Now, the law does say explicitly that cannot be factored into health insurance decision-making, but there are ways to do that. And certainly, the Medicaid and Medicare programs will probably do it first, and private insurance generally follows what Medicare and Medicaid does. So, yes, there is a comparative effectiveness model out there, and there's lots of money being put into that so that we get better information about what works and what doesn't.
So in the context of the moral hazard insurance resources, I think one solution is a high deductible plan. How does the current health care bill incentivize something like that, where it's more putting the cost signal to the patient so that they have a greater stake in how much health care it is? Is there any program that steers that way? And if so, or not, are the high deductible health care plans disincentive to the point that
The problem with those is twofold. One is that the patients don't theoretically possess the knowledge to use them accurately. But the more interesting one is, what if they don't take care of themselves and it's their own fault, and then they become sick? Who's supposed to take care of them? You know, the way they manage irresponsibility in the undeveloped world is they step over you on the sidewalk when you fall down. We're not willing to do that. This whole move toward libertarian, take care of yourself, people should be more responsible for their own vices and suffer the consequences, works great if you're a hard-hearted society. Don't wear your motorcycle helmet, have a head injury, tough luck. You become vulture bait by the side of the road. We're not willing to do that. What we do then is expect them to pick up that patient and take them somewhere, and they should take care of him somehow.
Sorry, the high deductible plan is where you pay
Right, but then you pay for your own health care.
Until you meet the deductible.
But what happens then if you take bad care of yourself because you don't feel like spending that money? Are you the only one that suffers? Or does that suffering get spread around the rest of us? And why should we tolerate that?
Well, just to let you know, there will be HSAs in the exchange, and for young adults up to the age of, I'm not exactly sure what age it'll be, I think 29, they have what's called, they will be under the insurance, the individual mandate to purchase insurance. Young adults may purchase catastrophic only plans. They're the only population cohort that can, because it will be more affordable for them, and because it's generally a very healthy group of people.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Those make economic sense, but they require two things: that you have an intelligent population who makes wise decisions about things they're going to have to pay for themselves, and that you still have a safety net. Because people don't behave, even though they're supposed to, and even though we want them to, and we like to punish them when they don't, people don't behave. Behave.
By the way, this discussion, I think, is interesting in view of the objection, the libertarian objection that we're hearing on the individual mandate. You know, the objection is the government is forcing me to buy insurance. It's forcing me to buy an economic product, and this is violating my freedom. Okay, and I guess you know, there's lots of different responses that could be made to that. But one of them is that unless you're fabulously wealthy, you're being completely hypocritical, because you will want, if you're there on the sidewalk bleeding out, the society will take care of you. I.e., we will be taking care of you. Okay, so I think that really blunts the force of that sort of libertarian objection to mandatory insurance.
Well, I have a friend who couldn't be here tonight, who is the furthest thing from a libertarian, but she's been unemployed for a couple of years. She doesn't have health insurance, and she's equally concerned that she's going to be forced to pay for insurance because she literally can't afford it, and she's on food stamps, and she's not going to meet paper rent. So how are these, how are we going to meet those needs?
Well, go ahead.
There will be subsidies. No, yeah. I've talked a lot. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. No, I was going to say the same thing. Really, yeah. There are supposed to be subsidies. There are programs that you should be able to qualify for. And if not, well, you know, that is a serious problem.
There are going to be subsidies up to 400% of the federal poverty level. That's about $44,000 for an individual. If you make much less than that, then you get a very generous subsidy, and it says you will not have to pay more than X percent of your income before the government comes in and helps you. And there's also limits on out-of-pocket spending above and beyond the premium. So if you're in that, and if she makes less than 133% of the federal poverty level, she'll get Medicaid. And the interesting thing about Medicaid is not a perfect, I mean, I agree with what Bob said, but for primary care physicians and for pediatricians, they will pay Medicare rates for Medicaid patients. So hopefully, maybe if you get 10 docs now who won't see Medicaid patients, maybe that'll reduce it to only 5. Because those physicians would see Medicare patients because the rates, Medicaid typically pays 72% of Medicare, and Medicare pays about, I don't know, 95% of private insurance. So if you move up that reimbursement scale, then maybe physicians will see Medicaid patients more, and maybe your friend, unfortunately, she won't get, well, I don't know what's going to happen with these high-risk pools that are rolling out in the next 90 days, I don't know what the subsidies will be. But by the time the mandate comes in, assuming her economic situation is the same as it is, my sense is she will be eligible for quite generous subsidies.
Let's hope.
Right here. I have a question about Medicare Advantage.
Uh-huh. Well, no. Do you want to?
Talking about Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is a plan that where the government was paying higher than Medicare rates to a private insurance company to come out with a fancy product that was supposed to do better. There isn't any evidence that it did anything more than spend extra money. So they're going to cut that out, and basically plain vanilla Medicare is what everybody's going to get. Unless you want to pay more yourself,
they're not getting rid of Medicare Advantage. They're going to pay right now. They're paying Medicare Advantage plans 114% of the Medicare fee. What they're going to say to the Medicare Advantage plans is, you're fine to keep rolling these out, but you know you're going to have to live within your means a little bit more, and in return. What it will actually do is extend the life of the Medicare Trust Fund and at least another couple of years, which is important since it's now scheduled to go broke in 2019. But from the end user, so if you have Medicare Advantage, it may mean that you may not get all the extra benefits they offered before. There may not be vision. There may not be gym memberships. There may not be certain things that drive up the cost that's not covered by regular Medicare, and you know, so there is 25% of all Medicare recipients have Medicare Advantage, and some of those people will probably not be happy.
All right, well, we've got to wrap it up, and as the moderator, I'm going to take the liberty of asking the last question that I think each of you will be able to weigh in on. So what I've heard tonight is that we've got three maybe different ways that we realistically may control costs in the future. Efficacy studies, a change away from the fee-for-service model, or some kind of a rational public discussion about what types of care we're going to prioritize over other types of care. Which of those, if any, do you think that our society is actually going to do?
The one thing we've proven that we're very good at is when we limit the fee-for-service model. In healthcare, form follows finance. And if you quit paying us to do stuff, we'll stop. And in fact, the key might not be to hit the wallet of the patient. The key might be to hit the wallet of the doctor. That there's a list of things I'm allowed to order and a list of things I'll be penalized to order. And if I keep ordering that other stuff, then you'll cut my pay or drop me off my reimbursement. Medicare has a huge club. If Medicare stops paying for something, it stops getting done. And if they would just quit paying for stupid things and pay more for smart things, we'll follow wherever you take us. But we're going to follow the money. So put the money where you want it spent, and we'll spend it.
But Carolyn was telling us earlier that a lot of times private insurers follow the lead of Medicare, and we're hearing from you that Medicare a lot of times is pretty stupid when it comes to where they use the club.
Mm-hmm. But if Medicare would just get smart, everyone else will fall into line.
And I'd like to weigh in on the side of comparative effectiveness studies. I think that it's going to take a while, but there is a small movement in the country working on the private side whereby it's called value-based reimbursement. So, and it's not for the physicians, it's for the users, it's for the patients, it's for the consumers, so that if you have a health insurance plan and you want drug X, and drug X costs four times more than the generic, and we know through comparative effectiveness studies that the generic works fine, then the insurance company will say, okay, if you pick the generic, we're going to cover it, but if you insist on going out to the third tier up there, you're going to have to pay four times more. Now, I realize that's a touchy subject because some people swear that the generics don't work for them, but there's a myriad of other examples. And so I think insurers, in order to control costs, will say to the consumer, this is what we know to be evidence-based medicine, and we're going to be good citizens, and we want you to stay well, but if you want to jump the queue and go outside, we're not going to pay for it. And my guess is that will really change behavior of consumers and patients.
Just one final
thought,
because I've got to go home and watch Lost. My wife is going to kill me if I'm late. That's new technology. We don't do that.
He's a philosopher.
Yeah, we just got a color set last year. These are all really good suggestions, and I was plumping for some kind of deliberative democratic process, which I think would build on what we're talking about to some extent here. You want the public to have a sense of what is effective and what is beneficial. My favorite economist, Uwe Reinhardt from Princeton, says we're not grown-ups, we're not adults about this. We just refuse to face reality. We all want everything. We don't want to pay for it, right? But there are examples. Like in Oregon, they actually had a public process. People participated. They realized that they had to set limits on the health care that people were getting, and they did it. Okay, and it's a publicly accountable system. So I think that the big problem is getting people to realize that there are limits. I think once people realize that there are limits and realize that real decisions have to be made, then we might make some progress. But I think that takes some kind of some notion of there being a ceiling out there, other than just open horizons of vast new technologies and new investments. Once you realize that there's a ceiling, as they have in the UK or Canada, or at Kaiser or Mayo Clinic, then people realize that, they've got to make tough choices. Okay, so I would want to just build on these suggestions that the public needs to know what's cost-beneficial and what isn't. Hopefully some rational decision-making will emerge from that.
All right.
He used to be in the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
You just have to educate the media.